I arrive at the dachem that she is the lady, and I found the money. I told her, and so I was counting those notes, trembling hands, as if it happened yesterday. I remember it so vividly. I'm cold, sweating. Like, Dimitri, you are an idiot. Stop it. Stop. Stop. And then there was this tiny voice somewhere in the back of my mind from the clouds, somewhere like, come on, what are you waiting for? This is your dream. Just do it. Freaking do it.
My name is Paul Harvey, and this is Life, Passion, and Business. We're about helping you explore, finding your passion for life and the work that you do. But it's so much more than that. It's about finding clues to the big life questions. What does it mean to be successful? What is the meaning of life? If you're looking for more, then join me on this journey, where together we will discover through interviews, tools, and tips how to live life full of meaning, passion, and purpose. When I was approached by Dmitry Badyarov, a musician and luthier, violin maker, I realized that my focus on business people had almost precluded the most passionate people on the planet. The music you can hear playing in the background is Dmitry and his wife, Tomi. The instruments they are playing were both made by Dmitry. One is a violin and the other is a violoncello da spalla. If I were to ask a random group of people what things are the most common passions, music would be high up on the list. But what is strange is music is all around us, and yet in the modern world, so few of us learn to play. In my parents' generation, everyone played something, and making music together was part of everyday life. I guess different times, no TV and no internet, of course. Dmitry is from a small town in southern Russia, and he started to play the violin at just age 8. By age 11, he was proficient enough to be tutored by a renowned professor. But try as he may, his factory-made instrument was not capable of making the beautiful sounds he was looking for. His professor introduced him to the local violin maker, and it was a life-changing moment. When Dmitry's love and passion for music grew to include the repair and making of instruments. Our conversation is full of imagery and wonder, and we talk about the mystique and mythology of famous instruments, and of course, his journey from the student to the master of his craft and a world-renowned violin maker. We hear how he struggled to make his first violin, working the wood on his lap with tools made from nail files. How he telephoned 300 friends and family to borrow $1,000 that would change his life. He left Russia to explore the world and eventually settled in the Netherlands and opened his first repair shop. There is the rediscovery of the ancient traditions and techniques of the master makers and how he champions the violoncello da spalla. It has been 28 years since Dmitry opened his first workshop, and he stopped repairing violins 20 years ago to focus exclusively on making unique instruments with the Baroque sound. In 2013, he suffered a cerebral stroke and was faced with the possibility of never playing or making another violin. After a full recovery, he recognized his limits. At this time in his life, he can only make 30 more instruments with the time that he has left. So it's time to pass on what he has learned to other ambitious instrument makers so his impact and work can continue. Today, his mission is to work with students to produce the best instruments, but also to develop their entrepreneurial skills so they get paid to be the best they can be. He wants them to thrive so that together they can ensure the ancient traditions live on and continue to enrich our culture. Ultimately, Dmitry's belief is that if you're going to make an instrument, leave a legacy, a mark the world can't ignore or erase. I hope you enjoy this rich conversation with Dmitry Badyarov. Today, I am delighted to be with Dmitry Badyarov. Now, he is a violin designer, a speaker, and a mentor. And I have to say, he's the first real musician I've had on the show. So I'm so delighted to have this conversation because, you know, I speak to entrepreneurs and business people, but it really is nice to talk to people who are in the creative sector. So thank you, Dmitry, for being here with me today. I'm so looking forward to this conversation.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Paul. I'm really, really grateful for the opportunity to talk to you and share my message and talk about life and passion and business and music and arts. I'm really, really wildly passionate about all those things. So,
well, it is interesting because, you know, when we think of passion, we do think of music and creative industries. We do think of people being passionate about their art. And of course, people are passionate about business and passionate about helping people. But the arts is the place where passion probably first started. So, and it's interesting, I have been remiss in terms of not bringing someone like you on the program before. So thank you for saying yes and being here today.
My pleasure, Paul.
So what's the story with you? What is your story? Obviously, I know you're a violin maker, which I think is fascinating. I'm sure we'll explore that story. But how did it all start for you in the beginning?
Great question, Paul. So I started as a violin maker when I was a kid. I was 11 years of age. And the reason I started as a violin maker is because I was also playing the violin. I started at the age of 8. So it was one of those days when I had a lesson with my beloved professor, Simeon Ziskind. We are still in a very close relationship. It's a lot of time, a lot of years have passed since then. And he's absolutely brilliant person. He's like my musical father. He's almost like second father for me. And he's a brilliant teacher. And he's the one who planted this passion for music, for violin in all of his students. And I was blessed to be one of them. So we were working on the sound. Imagine a very small room. Literally maybe 15 square meters in a kind of dormitory belonging to the theater in my hometown in the south of Russia. And we are working on the sound and I'm sweating and I'm struggling to get this beautiful sound. And Semyon Grigoryevich Ziskind stops me and says, "No, Dmitry, that's not sound. That doesn't sound good. That's not how you make good sound. Move the bow this way. Move the bow closer to the bridge, farther from the bridge, less pressure, more pressure," and on and on and on and on. And I felt almost discouraged and I just stopped playing at one point. Yeah, so to put it in perspective, I'm 11 years of age at that point. And I look at him and I look at his violin and I tell him, "Semyon Grigoryevich, look at your violin. You are playing a wonderful Italian instrument. And it doesn't matter how hard I work, how much I practice, I will never get that kind of sound. What if I first fix my violin? Does that make sense?" He agreed with me. So he introduced me to the violin maker in the town. And this was like a, I can't exaggerate if I say it was a life-changing moment, because this man, he was like a magician from a fairy tale. Imagine a man in his 60s maybe, with very, very thick eyeglasses. I don't know how thick the lenses were, but you know, his eyes, the pupils of his eyes were completely filling up those lenses like magnifying glasses. He probably couldn't see a thing without those glasses. And he had this most charming smile and quietness about him. And he was very slow and very, you know, like not rushy at all. And I fell in love with him before he even said anything. I just felt there was something magical about that. And of course, all these instruments around and tools and wooden shaving and smell of wood and varnish. And it's beautiful, like a very unusual atmosphere.
Someone so established in their art and in their skills. So at home in their body and so at home in what they did.
Yes, absolutely. And I don't know what happened on that moment in my mind. Instead of asking him, "Would you please fix my violin?" I ask him, "Would you please teach me how I can fix my violin?" It's like happened like that. And to my surprise, Well, he accepted me after a few questions. Why do you want to do that? And so on. So he accepted me. I became an apprentice to this magician. And in the beginning, the only thing I was doing was cleaning workshop, essentially. I wasn't doing anything much about violin making. But indeed, he taught me how to fix my really crude factory-made instrument. And of course, it hasn't become an Italian violin. Surely not. But it has become a little bit better. But this tiny difference was so huge for me that was really inspirational.
I'm curious, what did he have you do to the violin that changed?
That was very easy to fix. It was a violin that was kind of a varnished wooden box, essentially, but everything was really crude and really wrong about it. So essentially, he opened it for me. Well, actually, he taught me how to open the box, measure the thicknesses, and he explained, well, see here, the thickness is way too thick. We have to reduce that. Here are the thicknesses are very sloppy. We have to make them more even. And so we took apart the whole violin and then assembled it back a couple of months later. Mm. And it, of course, became better because
as you say, a factory violin is produced out of factory wood and there's no tolerances, or the tolerances are poor. And then obviously when you take it apart and you actually measure it and beautifully craft away the wood, I imagine you make the resonance of the real wood come out.
Yes. So this was very inspiring. So when the instrument was closed, there was so much more resonance, was so much more, so much easier to play. Mm-hmm. And just that difference in that instrument made me exponentially better player. But probably that's how I felt at that moment anyway. And I then fixed the violin for my brother, because my brother is also a violinist, and then started fixing violins for all of the students of my professor. And this is how I got initiated into instrument making. However, it was not until much later when I actually built the whole instrument from scratch for myself. That was later in 1992 in St. Petersburg, when I moved to study at one of those elite schools of music in St. Petersburg. And it's 2,000 kilometers up north from my hometown. Yeah, so the new era and new chapter in my life began. Yeah.
And you better tell me, what was the passion driving you here? Because I can imagine it. I'm almost there with you with this violin. I can feel it. But for my listeners, explain what the difference is for you.
Yeah, that's a very subtle question. We can speak about this days, maybe even weeks. You see, imagine yourself in that school. It's a very elitist school for it had even an elitist name. It was, back in those years, it was called the school for unusually gifted children or something along these lines.
Okay. You know,
whatever. So today it is called a lyceum, music lyceum, but back then it was called a school for specially gifted musician children. So the competition was fierce. There was like 70 applicants per place. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of I don't know how I made it, but I was accepted. And in that school, all of the kids were playing unbelievable instruments. Like these instruments today, they cost in like six and seven figures of like millions of pounds or euros or dollars. This is the kind of instruments back then kids played at the school, because their parents were wealthy and all were very established musicians. There were lots of celebrities, kids of celebrities at my school. It was really fun, were very high environment for high performance, one of those hotbeds for music talent. Definitely did help in a big way that school. And I felt myself really terrible and kind of inferior. I was even bullied by some people, including professors. Because I was playing that 19th century or early 20th century factory-made German violin. And it was not a terrible instrument, but in comparison to those Italian instruments or French instruments, it was a very crude instrument. It was very cheap. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, how can I help myself out of this situation? Because I just didn't see the way. Where can I find a spare six figures or seven figures to buy one of those violins? Yeah, yeah. So the only way I found out was to make it myself.
Yeah, absolutely. I can see that.
And that's where, and my former master from my hometown, Nalchik in Caucasus, he encouraged me, Dmitry, you are now in St. Petersburg, you definitely have to find there an instrument maker apprentice and carry on with your training and education, start making instruments. And it took 6 years to find somebody because yeah, there were plenty of instrument makers, but nobody wanted to have apprentices because I don't know, maybe they felt they didn't want to have more competition or whatever reason, but they didn't want to have
instrument makers then. So does each instrument maker have their own, do they have like a following of an instrument maker? Because it's like, you know, it's like, yeah, I mean, we all know Stradivarius is an amazing instrument maker of his day. I mean, are the modern instrument makers of the same ilk or the same level?
Oh yeah, sure. Yes. They are instrument makers living today and making instruments very, very comparable to the finest antique instruments, including Stradivari. And it has been all over the news. There were many double blind tests comparing newly made instruments against multi-millions, Stradivari violins, and professionals and audiences, professional players, and also audiences were mistaking modern instruments for the antique instruments because there is this presumption that antique instrument must sound better, which is not true at all anymore. Maybe it was true once upon a time.
Well, I guess it would have been true. It would have been true. Now the knowledge is easier to...
Exactly.
You can take a violin apart and look at it at a degree you could never do it before. Yes, I can see that. Very true. And do violins have that kind of history and thing like you know, you think of a sword that carries its history with it, you know, a sword that was used in this battle and this battle. Are violins the same? Do they carry that mythology down with them over the years?
Yes, there is, of course, this sort of mythology with attached to violins, certain violins. So there is a lot of history attached to antique instruments, and musicians definitely love instruments, love the idea of playing an instrument that belonged to a legendary violinist in the 17th or in the 19th or 20th century, for example. So there is a lot of that. Or even just a violin that belonged to an Uncle Joe or or an Auntie Harriet, something like that, something from the family. So yeah, there is this. However, there is much more. It's very interesting that you ask this question, because the thing is, a violin as an object hasn't appeared on an empty space without any foundation, without any cultural background, any philosophical background. It was a fruit of its own time and culture, and it has been based on actually hundreds, even thousands of tradition of thought, European thought, the Pythagorean traditions and all the influences of the Pythagoreans and the Renaissance and Baroque aesthetics, everything has been melted into the violins. The violins are like almost a quintessence of what we can call a European culture today. Mm. By borrowing from Hermann Hesse here, because in the glass bead, he says that music is the quintessential gesture of European culture. So in a way, violin is also that quintessential gesture, because the truth is, violin is the core of a classical music ensemble.
But it's the sound, isn't it? I mean, the violin sound itself is so evocative of it's almost pure emotion to me, in a way, that the sound of the violin is so raw and at the same time can have such color to it.
Yeah.
It's a voice of its own. It's like the human voice. Some human voices have this, but the violin played well always has this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a very enigmatic.
And you think about that, it can do the classical, the beauty of the classical, and it can do the Irish jig and the fiddle, and it's like, and the Scottish music was used the same, and it has that color that it can cover all of those bases.
Absolutely, it's such a versatile instrument. It's funny you mentioned Scottish and Irish music. I absolutely love that repertoire. Absolutely love it.
So I've gone on a journey with you. I'm sorry, I've gone a bit geeked out on this whole idea talking about the violin and that. I've come off your story. So you're now in this place, you found a new instrument maker. Let's get back to the story, because I'm sorry I took you off on a journey.
All right.
Well, so wait, you found this, did you find a new instrument maker to work with?
Yes. So after 6 years of searching in St. Petersburg, late 1980s, Finally, I found an instrument maker who accepted me as an apprentice, and that's where I built my first violin, my proper violin. I was in 1991, 92. Yeah, it was 1991 when I was making it. Imagine a room, actually it was my bedroom, in a residential block, a very Soviet style, like nothing special, just many floors, essentially, on the 12th floor, with a view of Baltic Sea from the window. By the way, that view has completely gone now. There are blocks and blocks and blocks of buildings there. But back then, there was this view of the sea from the window. And I was making the instrument literally on my lap because I didn't have a bench like the one I see here behind my back. No,
okay,
a proper bench that weighs 120 kilograms. I didn't have a bench. All I had was my lap and a few tools that I made from fingernail files.
Oh, wow. Right.
Because I didn't have any tools. So I made those tools from fingernail files. You couldn't buy tools in the Soviet Union. It was very difficult. And I was building the violin on my lap, literally.
Where did you get the materials from? I mean, is the wood very unique?
Yeah, the materials, yeah. Actually, I went to the Carpathian Mountains to cut the wood by myself. I did that. So I have that chapter in my life as well. But the hardest part was the tools. I didn't have the tools and you couldn't buy them anywhere. You had to make them. They were really crude and it was a really rough problem to have. And one day, the phone rings, one of those old phones with dial ring, you know, very old fashioned. The only thing that we had back then just rings. It rings as I'm making the violin. I pick the phone and there was my professor, my teacher, violin making teacher. And actually, would you like to buy some violin making books? Because look, I have all these books. I have everything. I don't need anything, but you don't have any books. Do you want to buy some? Because there is a widow of a violin maker who deceased, who passed away 30 years ago or something like that. So she's moving away to live with her relatives or something, and she's selling books. And I was, of course, very enthusiastic about it. Yes, sure, of course, I want those books, definitely. So the next day, I take local train, 80 kilometers, and I travel to this, it was September, beautiful. I still remember as if it was yesterday. Golden autumn, warm, dry, smell of pine, coniferous trees in the area, and even mushrooms from the forest, because it was like an area, whole area surrounded by forests and lakes, and beautiful. So I arrived there, imagine a Russian-style dacha, like a blue-painted wooden house with three windows with white frames, quite dilapidated because it hasn't been maintained for decades, surrounded by pine trees, all very tall pine trees. So I enter and I bump into the widow, elderly lady, 92 years of age she was.
Wow.
So as I enter to the room, squeaky floors, like it smells very old and smells wood, squeaky floors, and there she is. And she explodes, like, oh, Dima, yeah, I heard about you. Oh my goodness. And she told me how she met Mravinsky, Prokofiev, Rostropovich, all these celebrities as the luminaries of music culture of the 20th century, you were visiting them. And she told me, oh, Dima, no, I just started to feel a little bit old. I said, Jesus Christ, she's 92 years old. And she's telling me she's just started to feel a little bit old. And I said, oh my goodness, I want to be like her when I'm 92. Yeah, yeah. My God. What a brilliant young girl is, 92 years young girl. Like incredible memory, incredible wit, humor, and vivid storytelling. Amazing. She's just like, you know, she painted these figures of celebrities visiting her husband in her apartment in St. Petersburg. It was fantastic. So anyway, I bought those books, and then she said, Dima, do you want to buy some violin making tools as well, because look, I have a ton of tools.
Oh, wow.
My jaw just dropped, like, tools? Violin making? What? It was not only tools, not only violin making tools, those were 19th century British tools.
Wow.
Most of them handmade, like, Dream coming true in the most incredible way. Unbelievable tools, chisels and planes and everything. So beautiful museum items, collector's items. So I said, yeah, of course, I want to buy them all because I didn't have any tools. And then she said, she named the price and she said, $1,000.
Wow.
Okay. And wow, exactly. But the thing is,
1990, $1,000 is a lot of money.
You know, look, so it was a collapse of Soviet Union.
Mm.
Dollars, just a few months or a year before that, if authorities found you owning some dollars, you would go to jail. It was illegal to own dollars. So dollars were a rarity.
Okay.
On top of these, real estate property was just privatized. So it was the first year or a couple of years in the history of Soviet Union, someone could buy an apartment or a house. And nobody believed that the state would not come after you and take your property away again, which is why these properties were on sale. For $1,000, you could have one room flat in St. Petersburg. Today, it is a fortune.
Mm.
Imagine.
I imagine. Yeah. Wow.
Well, that was a lot of money and I didn't have that kind of money. So I was really frustrated and very, very sad. And I came back home and I thought, what can I do? What can I do? Where can I find this money? And I shared with my relatives and friends and everybody. So, well, if you can't afford, you can't afford. What can you do? Yeah. And then just something clicked in my mind. Well, I'm going to borrow this money. And I rang like maybe 200 friends and friends of friends. I spent 3 days full time calling friends of friends of friends. Would you please borrow me $5, $10, $20, whatever you can borrow me. Could you please, please, please? And believe it or not, in 3 days, I was able to collect this $1,000.
Well done.
And I was told by everyone, my relatives, friends, Dimitri, you are nuts. You are done. You will never, ever be able to pay back that debt. They will come after you. You will go to jail. You will take all your family with you to jail. You are irresponsible. You are selfish. You are
dead. How many loans did you get? How many people did you loan?
I think it was
money?
Like 50 people, about 50 people.
Oh, well, okay.
Yeah. Wow. Very doable. Yeah. Very, very doable. You
know? Yeah.
So, yeah. And it took just, you know, 3 days, maybe even less, 2 days and a half, something like this. So anyway, I got this money. I arrived in that countryside house. I was so scared to carry this fortune on me. It is a dangerous criminal time, you know, in Russia, back in those years, people would kill you for $100, you know. And I was there with the pockets full of
Yeah, I'm sure.
Goodness. So anyway, I arrive at that dacham that she is, the lady, and I found the money, I told her, and so I was counting those notes, trembling hands, as if it happened yesterday. I remember it so vividly. I'm cold sweating, like, Dimitri, you are an idiot. Stop it. Stop. Stop. And then there was this tiny voice somewhere in the back of my mind from the clouds, somewhere like, come on, what are you waiting for? This is your dream. Just do it. Freaking do it. And I've done it. So, yeah, I came back home and, there were so many tools. I had to travel like 2-3 times to bring them all because I didn't have a car.
Yeah.
And so I had to travel several times to bring those tools. And I gave some of those tools as a present to my violin-making teacher who introduced me to the lady. So it was like the official birth of my violin-making studio. The violin that I was making, half of it was made on my lap, got a prize at the violin-making competition in Moscow. And... yeah.
So what did you sell your first violin for?
It wasn't sold. Unfortunately, it was stolen.
Oh, that's no good.
That's not good. Yeah, that's not good. But the thing is, you know, I believe there's something in the universe. I don't know. You know, if when an artist is really, truly passionate about their stuff, if they really commit, they kind of connect to some energies. I don't know how you can explain this, but then just like a universe starts giving you its helping hand. You get noticed for that passion because you are, I don't know. probably that's how it works. And I really feel a little bit sad that to see today so many artists, instrument makers, musicians, not believing in what they are doing, not believing in their passion, not sharing their passion. They are doubting. And then if people doubt, well, potentially they do not commit fully, you know, and if you don't commit fully, how can you succeed? And
so how many violins have you made since those days?
Great question. In the early days, I didn't count them. So I started counting them maybe 19 years ago. Mm-hmm. To be exact, 19 years ago. So the counted ones are about 113, 114 instruments, something like this. I reckon it might be a little bit more than that, but something like that, 100.
And I'm curious, obviously you took this major loan out. How long did it take you to pay it back?
Oh, that was paid back in no time.
I'm sure, because making a violin and making a good violin with good tools, you can.
Good violins, no. I wish. I couldn't sell those violins even for $500, but that's how I was able to pay back that loan is because, yes, true, I made a few instruments and I sold them still, even if they were very cheap. but there were so many violin repairs coming into my workshop that I reckon I was able to pay back all this debt in less than a year.
Oh, wow. Well done. That's amazing. Yeah. It's an amazing story. And so, I mean, is violin making and maintenance still part of your life?
Not at all. No, I stopped making, I stopped maintenance, stopped repairing instruments. At a certain point, I realized that the main purpose why I became an instrument designer, is an instrument maker, is to design and make instruments rather than repair instruments. So, yeah, 20 plus years ago, I just gave myself a promise, never again. I just don't dedicate my time to the repair or restoration or...
Unless someone brings you that unique, special, amazing violin, you're not going to be tempted to pick up some amazing piece of 17th century history that you're holding in your hands.
Great question, Paul, actually. You know, so... I've been there and I did make a few exceptions, restoring some amazing instruments. It was fun, good fun. Well, like somebody brings you a masterpiece from the 18th century and half of it is eaten by worm or something.
Yeah,
like
I mean, you owe it to the world to bring this instrument back to life, don't you, in a way?
it is an incredible amount of work to restore instruments. It's just such an incredible... It's like you need to have a passion for this.
I know.
And at a certain moment, I had to choose, okay, what is my main thing, restoring instruments or making instruments? And I decided, no, absolutely, it's making instruments, not restoring.
I mean, this is one of those, there's a synergy here in a way. And this is restoring a unique piece of history is worth doing. And that's really worth doing. But I mean, it's the same in the world around us. You know, I live in a old house. My house is 1893. And, to do any work in this house or any repairs in this house is a major exercise because it's such an old house. So as soon as you do anything in it, touch anything, you suddenly notice, oh, that's got to be done. And that's got to be done. So I guess when you're working with something that's such an old piece of kit, you really do have to kind of think about how you move forward with it. So it's really interesting.
Absolutely.
Whereas when you start from scratch, you start with a clean slate and you can create what you want, can't you?
Yes. Very true. So there is a lot of responsibility in dealing with valuable antique instruments. Mm. A lot of knowledge, a lot of tradition has been lost because of restorations and repair. Because just like if you get an instrument and you have to fix something, inevitably things get changed. And in this process, a lot of valuable information about how the instruments were created, what is the cause of the whole thing, all of a lot of this information has been lost.
Yeah.
And it is of course a responsibility. Like, you know, if you go to any museum, art museum, of course they have an enormous collections and each work of art has been restored probably countless of times.
Mm.
But the thing is, each work of art has a file of all of the repairs and restorations, all of the interventions done on a specific work of art, who were the people involved, what has been done, what materials has been used.
Yeah.
Everything is documented. But with instruments, it has not been done in the same way.
Yeah. You don't know it's past. Yeah.
Which is why lots of information has been lost. And my big passion is actually one of the reasons I am an instrument maker was to rediscover that old masters' thought process, their philosophy, what were those ideas, the culture that fed the whole thing. Because today, if you make an instrument, so like mainstream in making violins in today's industry, for example, is making copies.
Mm.
So you get a model of a famous Stradivari violin or a Guarneri violin or something like this, and then you make a copy using that poster photograph of a violin. But what is the reason? What are the reasons behind these gracious outlines? Why it's shaped that way? That is not quite, it has not been quite known, and it has always been a big puzzle for me since 1984 or 1985, something like this. And I really had that burning desire to find out the thought process of the ancient masters, because back then they didn't have posters to copy from. They had to create instruments from scratch.
Mm, so yeah, of course.
What was the foundation beneath? So for me, it was very important to find that basis, this foundation.
Have you discovered it? Yes.
You
now produce instruments that are created to your vision, or how do you copy instruments, or are you creating new instruments now?
Yes, I'm creating new instruments. So I create instruments based on the thought process of the ancient masters that I have discovered. I call it the old masters tones technique, because tones actually is an acronym. It stands for 5 steps of the process that I'm using to design original instruments, and it is based on historical documents, the surviving documents and instruments that confirm this theory that it works. It took me actually 28 years to find out how all this thing works.
We
can speak about this forever. It's something that I also teach my students, instrument makers, how to design instruments using that ancient master's thought process, so that they can create unique original instruments to support unique musicians' needs.
So have you continued the tradition and taken on apprentices of train for instrument making and repair?
Yes, I'm the founder of Authentic Instrument Makers Academy, and this is where I teach instrument makers how to design instruments using that ancient master's thought process and other elements pertaining to our art and craft.
Wonderful, wonderful. So at some point you left the Soviet Union, by the sound, because you're not speaking from there now. You're now in The Hague, I seem to remember.
Yeah. I'm in The Hague.
Was that a move because it was easier to work in The Hague, or what caused you to change country?
Oh, yeah, great question. So, left Russia 26 years ago or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so first I lived in Brussels. And the reason I moved to Brussels was because I wanted to be in Europe. I wanted to be closer to the cultural roots of the violin,
of course,
to do more research around the violin, travel around the countries and learn more. So that was one reason. Another reason was to study with celebrated, absolutely fantastic musician, violinist, conductor, founder of an orchestra, one of the most famous orchestras, La Petite Bande. Professor Sigiswald Kirken, and he was teaching in Brussels in 1994. So this is why I moved to Brussels. So I lived in Brussels 12 years. Then I lived 5 years in Japan. And now we are in The Hague since 10 years. Since 10 years, we are in The Hague. We love The Hague. We love the Netherlands. A wonderful country and a wonderful city.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've been there once, I seem to remember. But but it's amazing that you've traveled so far in Japan and all those places, and the violin has been the story behind it. Or it's a lovely, lovely story, lovely journey.
Yep.
So What has been your success model for you? How have you defined success in your life?
Well, that's a glorious question. Easy to ask, difficult to talk about. Yeah, and this is a wonderful question. So I think success in life for a human being is to be able to create a life model, career model, that would be in line with one's core values, personal values. Mm-hmm. So for me, definitely it is to enable other instrument makers to become more successful as instrument makers, to keep that tradition of violin making, original violin making alive, this tradition based on thousands of years of European culture, mm-hmm. so that they can create more incredible instruments to help more musicians. So it's like basically helping as many people as possible to get what they want in their lives. This is when you can have whatever you want to have in your life. And for me, definitely, it has to be in line with your personal values. Hmm. Because otherwise, you can be very successful and still very unhappy. So then it's not really success. But if
tends to happen then is someone's following someone else's success model and then the two things don't fit. That's what tends to happen.
Yeah,
because they do this because their parents said that they do this because their parents always wanted them to do this, and they get there and go,
for example,
this was not
true.
What I wanted, you know.
True. Yeah, that's very true. So, one of the reasons I'm dedicating now so much more time, so much more focus to helping other instrument makers to build more successful instrument making businesses, and participate in the revival of the Violoncello da Spalla. So this is one of the things I'm perhaps the most known for, and also to keep the old master stones technique alive and create more original models. It's more in line with my personal core values. So when I do this and when I see smiles of my students, it's just like, what can be happier than that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I can see that. Yeah. So what's been the low points? What's kept you going in the low points? Because there must have been some, this is a journey, obviously. There's obviously some great moments, and there must have been some, now what do we do, moments.
The easy answer to this is probably my craziness, my passion for what I do. I guess it's that. But if we speak about low moments, yeah, there were several low moments. It's very important to figure out what is the lesson in the low moment, and what can you do to turn this around and make it the best experience ever in your life. So what am I speaking about exactly? I'm speaking about one of those low moments in my life when on January 19, 2013, I suffered a cerebral stroke, and that wasn't fun at all. You know, so it was like lying in the bed, half paralyzed, and I thought I can never play the violin anymore. I can never make violins ever again.
Wow!
I would be lucky if I could walk and speak normally. Well, I asked the doctor, "Do you think I will be able to work as a luthier or be a musician?" Mm-hmm. And the doctor said, "You will be lucky if you will relearn to speak again." That was the situation.
Not a good bedside manner, that's for sure.
Yeah, it wasn't very fun.
How did you turn that around?
Well, the thing is, probably I wouldn't be able to do this without my wife, but she was really the person who helped me to see things that I hadn't seen. Because definitely at that low moment in my life, I just wished to die, because I thought to spend the rest of my life in bed, to be a burden.
Yeah.
I really love life, and like I love travel, I love doing things, I love having fun in life. Just stay in the bed, not really interesting thing to do. But then my wife told me, Dimitri, don't worry about this. First thing first, you will recover. Second thing, even if you never play again the violin, if you never can make instruments again, no problem. Imagine how many people's lives you can inspire and can change if you simply share your knowledge around, how to be more successful freelance professional in music, how to be more successful as an instrument maker, how to design instruments with total certainty. And that was like a wow. I thought, it's completely makes sense because
so you had something to reach towards, you had something to move towards. She gave you the vision that you needed to recover.
Yeah. And I realized, true, I could have died actually on that day, and I could have taken all my knowledge with myself to the grave. So then what is the value in all this knowledge? What is the value in all this sacrifice and this passion and doing things if no one knows, no one can benefit from this? And from that moment onward, my life started slowly changing to the point where I am today. And it's absolutely, it has been absolutely amazing journey. This is what I mean by in the low moments, a person needs to ask himself or herself a question. What does that mean? How can I turn this around and make this low moment the best moment, the best experience in my life ever?
Yeah. And that's the truth of it, isn't it? We can only ever see these points from looking back. You can't see them when they're happening. You only see the benefit of them when you look back.
Very true.
And I imagine that experience in 2013 meant when you actually did get back, you appreciated what you did all the more and gave it all the more passion and energy than you had done prior to that.
Very true, Paul. Yes.
So I know the answers to this. I could answer it for you, but I'm not going to. What has been your contribution to the world?
I think that my main contribution, undeniably, I'm the most known for the rebirth of the violoncello da Spalla. So this is the predecessor of the modern day cello. There's a notion repertoire musicians can explore. It's an enormous, it's such an incredible instrument. It's actually behind my back, one of the instruments. Work in progress. So it is a small cello held, played against the shoulder. A violinist or viola player can play it. It was the instrument of choice for many important Baroque composers, notably for Johann
Sebastian. So it's an instrument that has kind of fallen out of favor and you're bringing it back?
Yes. Yeah, it has fallen out of favor for a number of reasons, but it is still an amazing instrument. There is a lot of repertoire that can be played on this instrument, cello repertoire, violin repertoire, any kind of repertoire, because it's such a versatile instrument with incredibly warm, beautiful human voice. And any open-minded violinist or violist, especially freelancer who also organize their own concerts on the side, like by themselves or even on the side, could explore in an instant, explore absolutely an ocean of untouched repertoire and play on this instrument, which is a magical instrument. And there is virtually no competition. And when a violinist, someone who is feeling that they deserve to be more recognized, they deserve to be seen for their love of music, for their passion, but just because there is a hell of competition in classical music, they do not get that exposure that they deserve. So then the violoncello da Spalla is a very easy switch because it is an incredible.
Can you say the name of it slowly? Because you say it so quickly, I can't hear it.
It is a violoncello.
Violoncello.
It is Italian for cello.
Lovely.
Da Spalla, which means shoulder. Da Spalla, shoulder cello. However, composers in the 18th century didn't call it violoncello da Spalla. They simply called it cello, violoncello. Yeah, so that's one thing. And another thing is my contribution to the world is keeping the tradition of violin making, original violin making, as a cultural tradition alive in Europe, and empower violin makers to create businesses that they absolutely love. They create instruments with total certainty for the musicians in their countries, in their cities, using the old master stones technique, this method that I've discovered. It took me 28 years to discover. It's a beautiful method. It's so beautiful, so simple, so elegant. Mm-hmm. It's like a 5 years young kid can memorize it in seconds, and which is why ancient masters in the 17th or 18th century have never left a treatise about how to design violins. It's very crazy because in those years, those centuries, they have created a treatise about almost everything. Mm-hmm. Architecture, painting, sculpture, cooking, makeup, whatever. There is a treatise about absolutely everything. But about the violin, well, there is one German author who wrote in a historical book, 1636 or something like that. We are not going to speak about violins because the violin is such a known instrument.
Oh. But of course,
he thought about the 21st century.
Yeah. Yes, of course. Yeah.
But when he discovered this method based on historical sources, which were lost even already in the 18th century Italy, the people in Italy already didn't know about this, just like everything made sense. Of course, it is so simple. Of course, you do not need 350 pages manual on how to design an instrument, because it's very, very simple. And anyone, even not instrument maker, can complete a design, and it will have a very solid acoustical structure built into. And it's based on thousands of years of European culture. So like speaking about instruments with a story, there we go.
That's fascinating.
A story much deeper than an instrument belonged to Auntie and Harriet, you know, or Uncle Joe.
So tell me, what is the one question that I haven't asked you that I should have done?
What a difficult question, Paul.
What is the, okay, I'll rephrase it for you. What is
we have talked about so many things.
What is the one question you like people to ask you?
How to be more successful as a freelance creative, perhaps.
So how do you be more successful as a freelance creative?
Share your passion. Speak about this.
Yeah.
People need it. People need someone to inspire them. People don't need more artists complaining about how difficult the world is and how unfair the world is. Just share your freaking passion and people will be drawn to you because they need someone to guide, because this is the virus in today's society: a lack of passion, lack of commitment, lack of faith in themselves. They are doing the right thing, being 100% sold out on the stuff that you are doing.
Yes,
you're getting this, and well, if you commit fully, of course you get results.
Of course.
And if you do not commit fully, of course you don't get results. It's as simple as that.
Which is exactly why you borrowed your $1,000 and you did it.
Exactly.
And we've come full circle, which is lovely. Thank you for that. That's really, really a fascinating story. So look, we're coming close to the end of our time together. So what is it that you want? Who would you like to speak to? If people want to reach out to you, who needs to talk to you? Who do you want in your life from this?
Of course, I want... I'm very passionate about creating very high-end instruments of the violin family. So I would be very delighted to help ambitious musicians to fulfill their musical and personal and artistic aspirations with a custom-designed instrument that is made specially for them.
Wow.
That's one thing. And another thing is, I was thinking about this many, many, many years. Like, I'm now 52. If I make instruments at my current pace and I don't want to increase the production, it's completely outside of my plans, I would be able to make, 30 instruments more? Maybe. It's like a very, very, very limited production. So that means that I would be able to impact the lives of only
30
musicians or something like that, where I really prefer to help more instrument makers to create instruments the way I create them, so that they can create their own style, their own language, and create a legacy at bench. And I want to speak to artists to empower them and help them to become more recognized and more successful for who they are, because they absolutely deserve this.
So how would people get in touch with you? What's the best way to do that?
I'm all over the place. Okay. They can find me on Facebook. Okay. They can find me on my website, badyarovviolins.com. It's very easy. I'm very searchable.
Wonderful. So all those links will be in the show notes, and I'll also be at our website, lifepassionandbusiness.com. So it's all available there. So do reach out to Dimitri. I am sure it will be an amazing conversation, as I've had one here. So look, Dimitri, we get to the end of our conversation and we get to that final question, that really big question that we all at some stage in our life have to deal with. What is the meaning of life for you?
Help as many people get what they want in their lives.
That's easy enough. That's very simple and succinct. Well, thank you for that. I can't add anything to that. Well done. Thank you.
My pleasure, Paul. Thank you very much for your giving me the opportunity to share my message. It was absolutely enormous pleasure talking to you. Looking forward to potentially talking again in the future.
Absolutely. So Dimitri Badarov, thank you so much for your time today. It has been a genuine pleasure. I have really thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. All the best.
Thank you.
And that was Life, Passion and Business with Paul Harvey and my guest, Dimitri Badarov. Now, you may not be an inspiring luthier, but I do urge you to check out Dimitri's links and channels. In researching this program, I discovered Dimitri's YouTube channel and got lost watching him talk about instruments and playing the violoncello di Spalla, plus the duets with his wife Tomi. All well worth watching. Dimitri is taking the plunge and launching his own podcast called Luthiers and Legacy Show, and it happens on the 1st of May. I urge you to support the show. Check out the details of that. You'll find it at AuthenticInstrumentMakersAcademy.com. Now, you can find Dimitri at BadiarovViolins.com. You can also find him on Facebook, on Instagram, on YouTube, and on LinkedIn, of course. All of those links will be on the show notes above, but best probably find them at LifePassionAndBusiness.com, but those links will be live. I recently discovered a lot of the podcast apps don't do live links very well, so it is always best to go to the website and you'll get the link perfectly there. As I say every week, if you are enjoying this podcast, if you are enjoying any podcast, please support your content creators with likes and shares. And better still, if you can leave a review in the Apple world on iTunes, it does such a lot for the podcast owner and it's always greatly appreciated. As always, thank you so much for your time and attention, and I'll catch you next time. All the best.